Lesson 6, Chemical and Biological Attacks and Ghetto Medicine. To begin with, I want to address the 500-pound gorilla in the room, which is nuclear attack. I'm not addressing nuclear attacks in this course for the simple reason that we're trying to address as many high-probability disasters as possible in a limited amount of time. The chances of a conventional nuclear attack are several scales of magnitude lower than the chance of a chemical or biological accident, conventional terrorist attack, even ones including dirty bombs and EMPs, hurricanes, volcanoes, earthquakes, wildfires, or even economic collapse. Now, you couple this with the fact that at the same time, fallout shelters are expensive and take months to put in place. It just doesn't make sense in this venue. Now, at the same time, I can point you to several resources to help you get prepared for nuclear events, and I'll do a follow-up lesson on the topic if demand is high enough, but today it hasn't been, and for now we're going to spend time on events that are more likely to affect you, and also that have solutions that are broader in their possible applications. First of all, how great is the risk of chemical or biological attack? And let's go back and look at history real quick. And biological warfare has been effectively used since the Hittites herded victims of the plague in enemy lands back in 1500 BC. So quite a while. And chemical warfare has been used in the form of poison-tipped arrows since man began hunting. They're proven, and more importantly, they've benefited from thousands of years of use and refinement. And still, how big of a risk is it today? Well, to begin with, let's look at the Islamic terrorist groups that are operating openly in the U.S. 19 states have active, publicly known terrorist cells, ranging from the Muslim Brotherhood to Hamas to Al-Qaeda. And I've got a map on the resource page that you can take a look at that shows where a lot of these are. Now, I want to take a second to thank Kim at the Investigative Project on Terrorism for the use of this map and the research that went into making it. And you can actually, I'll give you the URL to go straight to the map. It's urbansurvivalplan.com/229/terrormap, TerrorMap. The second reason we need to look at chemical and biological weapons is that they're truly terrifying. Blistering skin, suffocating, loss of nerve control, organ liquefaction, sores, and the thought of mummy-like infected people coughing and spreading suffering and death is enough to keep a sane person up at night. The third reason we need to look at it is that the Soviet Union manufactured hundreds of tons of biological weapons, as well as 40,000 tons of chemical weapons. Some of these are still under Soviet control. Others were destroyed. Some sold to countries like Iran, and some of them have frankly been lost. A friend of mine from Provo, Utah, studied bioweapons under the head of the former Soviet bioweapons program, Ken Ellebeck, and contributed a lot of valuable information for the previous lesson and this one. According to Mr. Ellebeck, at the height of their production, they were manufacturing enough anthrax to kill the entire world several times over. Every week. And they had the capability to ramp up their production levels by several multiples if a conflict ever began. Now, the fourth reason that we need to be aware of chemical and biological weapons is that both Iran and North Korea have chemical weapons stockpiles and are working on biological weapons. Finally, we've seen both the manufacture and use of chemical and biological agents by individuals and terrorist groups in recent years, including the use of sarin gas, which is a chemical nerve agent, in the Japanese subway system in 1995. The attack happened in 5 subway cars at roughly the same time during morning rush hour. Now, keep in mind, a single drop of sarin the size of a pinhead can kill an adult. Each attacker carried at least 1,800 milliliters of sarin, almost 2 liters or 32 ounces, most of which was released, but injuries were limited to 1,100 and only 12 died. Post-September 11th, the anthrax attacks in 2001 by a former U.S. government scientist infected 22, and 5 of them died. In 2004, in Amman, Jordan, there was a foiled Al-Qaeda attack. This was pretty impressive. They had 20 tons of chemical agents, including 71 different lethal blister, nerve, and choking agents. The chemicals could be aerosolized and spread by 3 precise explosions designed not to burn up the chemicals. combination of chemicals meant that victims would have multiple symptoms and there would be no single effective treatment. The effective kill zone of the chemical cloud was expected to extend outward 1 mile from the explosions. In 2007, there were three dirty chlorine attacks in or near Baghdad. The first one was a pickup loaded with explosives and chlorine cylinders that was blown up, hospitalizing 55 and killing 5. In a separate incident, a bomb was detonated on a chlorine tanker, affecting 150 local residents. And in a third incident, a pickup was loaded with explosives and crashed into a chlorine tank, killing 12. Next is a 2008 ricin event. In that, a Salt Lake City man manufactured homemade ricin for, quote-unquote, self-defense and mishandled it in a Las Vegas hotel, causing him to be hospitalized. Now, ironically, when you understand the full significance of these five sets of incidents, they're five of the most comforting things you can know about the risks we face from chemical and biological attacks. To begin with, take a look back at the number of people killed in each attack. The deaths were all tragic, but they were relatively small compared to other attacks, like bus suicide attacks that happen all too often in Israel using conventional bomb vests. Just to recap, the sarin attack killed 12. The anthrax attacks killed 5. The three separate chlorine attacks in Baghdad killed 17. So the numbers aren't big. They could be, but in practice, they aren't. Next, take a look at the Japanese subway attacks. The loss of life was tragic, but the terrorists used enough sarin to kill thousands, tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of people. Instead, they killed 12. The group responsible, and I'm going to butcher the name here, but it's Om Shinriko, had millions of dollars at their disposal and had spent the previous 3 to 4 years trying to either buy or produce either a toxic strain of botulism or anthrax. They had PhDs, they had time, they had money, and they were not successful. Next, look at the proposed attack in Amman, Jordan. The death toll projections range from 20,000 to 80,000, with well over 100,000 injuries expected. This would have been tragic. It would have absolutely been horrible. But there's a silver lining here, too, and that is that the number of people who would have been killed were all within 1 mile of the chemical clouds. And outside of that kill radius, there would have been very, very few people killed. This is an important point because it brings up the fact that even if there is a large-scale chemical attack and the target is in the U.S. and the target happens to be in your city, the chances of you being directly affected are still very slim. Finally, we have 19 publicly known terrorist attacks that have been thwarted since September 11th. It would make sense that if terrorists intended to use chemical or biological weapons, at least one of these attacks would have been chemical or biological. While some of them planned on using conventional explosives to attack fuel targets or making a dirty nuclear bomb, none of them included biological or chemical attacks, let alone using the nightmare scenario of a crop duster to spread biological or chemical agents over a city. It hasn't happened. Let's compare this threat to a few other threats. Number one, malaria, tuberculosis, HIV/AIDS kill 5 million people every year. Smoking kills upwards of 5 million people every year, 443,000 of those in the U.S. Ordinary flu, just every year, kills an average of 36,000 people in the U.S. And finally, the cumulative total from the chemical and biological attacks mentioned above that span a 15-year period is 34 people, or roughly the number of people who die from the flu every 8 hours in the U.S. As you begin digging into the threat of chemical and biological attacks, you'll soon read several nightmare scenarios that have been put forth by various local, state, and federal authorities. And at first, the effects of a chemical or biological attack look horrible, with large percentages of cities suffering and dying. The bad thing is the statistics from these scenarios are used in news articles, fiction books, TV shows, and movies. They're also what most people think of when they think about the threat posed by chemical or biological attacks. If you dig deeper, though, you start to see that the technologies used aren't realistic. In the case of biological attacks, Ken Ellebeck and his Soviet scientists were scared of making dry powder smallpox. Why? Because it's so dangerous that it's nearly impossible to work with without becoming infected, even with the use of the best containment and decontamination methods known. Even so, we still game the use of dry powder smallpox in our scenarios and use infection and reinfection rates that are 3 to 5 times higher than what we know to be true or what scientists predict is even a worst case. With both biological and chemical attacks, the scenarios ignore how vulnerable potential toxic clouds are to environmental conditions such as temperature, humidity, elevation changes, wind, which can be too strong or not enough, and micro-weather patterns found in areas with lots of trees, hills, buildings, and even large black asphalt parking lots. With both chemical and biological weapons, the concentrations need to remain in a narrow range to achieve maximum death tolls. Too high of a concentration wastes the weapon, and too low of a concentration turns many weapons from killers into severe irritants. Fortunately, the response to a chemical or biological weapon attack is the same as the response to a chemical incident that we addressed in Chapter 3. So even though the chance of an attack happening that is in your city and that affects you is minuscule, we can create a response that is simple, inexpensive, and effective enough to be practical. In addition, the exact same response will protect you short-term in the event of a dirty nuclear attack. Let's look at your response. There's two responses you're going to want to consider if you have a chemical or biological event. One is to evacuate, and the other is to survive or shelter in place. If an event happens, the local government entity is going to suggest that everyone take actions that will make their response easiest and hopefully limit the number of casualties. This is not necessarily the best suggestion for you. As an example, let's say that I'm home with my family this evening and I hear a massive explosion. I go outside and see a giant cloud of smoke going into the air off to the northwest. I can't see the ground where the fire is or where the explosion was, but I know that there's a refinery 2 miles in that direction. As I'm looking, I hear multiple secondary explosions and see that the wind is blowing the cloud towards my house with a light breeze. I look at the trees in our neighborhood and estimate that the wind is blowing at 5 to 10 miles an hour at ground level, giving us about 12 minutes to get ready or leave, assuming that the wind isn't blowing harder at higher altitudes. I know that the smoke cloud shouldn't affect us at this distance, but I'd rather we didn't breathe in the chemicals or be around as the chemicals and debris start cooling, clumping with moisture in the air, and start falling back to Earth. My initial hunch is that this is an accident or an isolated attack, so I'm not concerned immediately about long-term security issues. Now, this all happened within 30 seconds of hearing the explosion. So there's nothing on the news yet, and there's not likely to be any increase in traffic yet. So we grab our home go bag, turn off the AC, lock up the house, top off our gas tank with our reserve fuel, hop in the car, and take off within 10 minutes of hearing the explosion. As we're driving off in the car, we hear that there was an accident at the refinery, and the official recommendation that people downwind from the refinery move indoors, seal their doors and windows, and stay calm. Of course, many people panic and leave when they hear the announcement, taking 30 minutes or more gathering belongings and actually leaving. Gas stations have lines from people who left home with empty gas tanks, and the roads leading away from the refinery are soon packed like rush hour. Meanwhile, as the congestion is building, we're already checking into a hotel in a neighboring town that's perpendicular and well away from the path of the smoke and debris. Our simple knowledge and preparedness allowed us to respond quickly, decisively, and calmly, and turn an event that was a full-blown drama for others into little more than an impromptu night or two away from home for us. Now, is that the best response? Maybe. There's several factors, but the speed that we were able to respond made leaving a viable option. If I'd ignored the sound of the initial explosion and tried to leave when the alert came on the air, we probably would have been stuck in traffic like everyone else and would have been better off surviving in place. Another factor is the overall civil situation in your area. If you're in the middle of a larger emergency, like being in New Orleans 4 days after Katrina, you may not have the option to leave quite so easily. As I mentioned before, if an incident like this happens while your family is spread out between work, school, and activities, you're probably not going to be able to stomach the thought of leaving without them. Anyhow, I couldn't. So what's the other option? Well, it's to survive in place. If evacuating is not an option, you've got two major strategies you can use. Number one, for an airborne threat where the contents of the air is the threat. And number two, for an epidemic like the flu or another biological event where the air is not dangerous, but other people are. If you're facing an airborne threat, you want to try and seal off a room or section of your house where you can stay for at least several hours, but possibly longer. Most chemicals dissipate within a few hours under normal atmospheric conditions, but an uncontained leak or an industrial fire could put contaminants in the air for much longer. Ideally, you want to pick a room or area that can be shut off from the rest of your house, has no windows, no air ducts, and hard floors. If that's not a possibility, pick the room with the fewest windows and ducts, and try to allow for at least 10 square feet per person for adequate oxygen. If you're in a situation where you need to use your safe room, make sure you take everyone's pulse every 10 to 15 minutes and write down the information. Now, your pulses will probably be elevated from the stress and rushing to get into the room, but if you start to see a sudden spike in your pulse after the 5-hour mark, it could mean you're running out of air and will need to prepare to leave your safe room immediately if anyone begins to pass out or is unable to stay awake. Keep in mind the 5-hour mark is merely a guide, and it'll be very different for two professional freedivers who have learned to control their breathing and heart rate than it will be for two large people who are prone to panic and hyperventilation. At this point, you'll have to make a choice as to what to do with your pets. They take air that you may need, and you may have bathroom messes to contend with, and they may cut your plastic with their paws if they hear outside noises. We've made the decision to include our pets, but we only have two dogs and understand the risks. Frankly, now is the time to decide what you're going to do with your pets in the event of an emergency. So take a minute and go ahead and pause this or stop it and just think about what you would do with your pets in the event of an airborne threat. Would you take them with you, or would you keep them outside of your safe room and hope that they make it through? It's a tough decision. There's no two ways about it. Now, since chemicals, chlorine for an example, are heavier than air and will tend to collect in basements, you ideally want to have your safe room on the ground floor or higher. Your first step in securing your house is going to be to limit the amount of outside air that can get into your house by turning off your AC, furnace, fan, shutting and locking all doors and windows, and closing your fireplace damper if you have one. If you feel like you have time, tape a sheet of plastic over your fireplace opening. Next, you want to create an interior safe room with an even higher level of safety. Here's how to create a safe room in your house. First, you need the following items: your home go bag, some thick plastic sheeting, and on the sheeting you'll see recommendations on thickness ranging from anything thicker than plastic wrap to 10 mils thick. We have 3.5 mil. And that being said, I wouldn't hesitate to use contractor trash bags or multiple layers of regular trash bags if I was away from home and that was all that was available. Third, you're going to want 3-inch wide duct tape if possible. And fourth, you're going to want a 5-gallon bucket with a lid and trash bags for your bathroom. That's going to be what you pee and poo in. And you also want toilet paper and wipes. If you've got time, you're also going to want the following: pillows, bedding, blankets, extra drinks, extra food, small books and games, urban survival playing cards if you've got them, a radio if you don't have one in your go bag, and a landline phone that's plugged into the wall and or a cell phone. And lastly, a great addition is chemical heat packs and foot warmers and or chemical cold packs, depending on the season. Now, as a note, everything except for the go bag will store easily in a closet in your 5-gallon bucket. Next, sealing the room. And just as a general note, our safe room is a bedroom and bathroom area. And it's not big enough to call it a suite, but it is an area that's separated from the rest of the house. And it gives us water, a toilet, a bed, and makes our safe room actually quite comfortable. So once everyone is in your safe room or safe area, the first thing you want to do is fill the crack under the door with trash bags, pillowcases, or clothes. And second, tape all the seams on your doors and windows. Third, using a utility knife, scissors, or pocket knife, cut a sheet of plastic for each door, window, vent, electrical outlet, or other openings to the outside for the rest of your house. You're going to want to make sure to allow an extra 3 to 5 inches of plastic on every side. When you're done, tape down the corners and then, using one single strip of tape per side, tape down the sides. Thick carpet poses a unique threat that you may not be able to get a good seal. Depending on the threat, you may need to find another room or cut through your carpet so that you can get a good seal between the plastic and the cement or wood below. Now, as a test, I suggest that you go out and buy a roll of 3.5-inch blue painter's masking tape, because it's designed not to damage paint when you pull it off. Go ahead and cut your plastic barriers and then tape them into place in your safe room with the blue tape. This will ensure that you have your plastic pre-cut, that you know how much tape you'll need, and as with any skill, your second time will be much faster than the first. Test out the blue tape on your walls before you go crazy with it. It's made to be easy to remove without damaging walls, ceilings, or floors, but you want to test it to make sure. As an additional step, spend 3 to 5 hours in your safe room so that you have experience using your 5-gallon bucket and know if you need other items. As a test to see how well your taping and sealing is, one simple strategy is to put yourself in the room while someone else cooks a pungent meal like curry, onions, or garlic in another part of the house. If you have a portable fan, it might help to even blow it towards your safe room. It should go without saying, but if you have thick carpet, do not cut it for the test. What if you're at work? Well, if you're at work when you need to create a safe room, the basic procedure is the same, except you will have the added challenge of blocking the air ducts. The best solution is to find out how to shut off air in the room you've chosen as a safe room ahead of time. If it's not obvious and you have maintenance personnel, they may or may not be willing to tell you how to turn off the air. If you can't turn off the air, you can still block it. Here's how. If possible, find a room where the fan doesn't blow as strong as the other rooms. Number 2, get access to the duct by removing the grate. Number 3, take an alcohol wipe or something similar and clean the duct near the grate so that your tape will stick. 4th, cut a sheet of plastic that's a couple inches bigger than the duct in every direction. 5th, tape the plastic sheet to the duct as close to the grate as possible. You may need to reinforce the tape by supergluing both the plastic and the tape to the walls of the duct. Depending on how strongly the fan is blowing, it may be very difficult to get a good seal. And 6th, using a pillow, crumpled up paper, or anything else handy, fill the 3.5-inch gap between the plastic and the grate due to the tape and reclose the grate. This will help support the plastic and take some of the pressure off of the duct tape. Now, in both your home and work situations, once you're in your room, listen to your radio until you receive the all clear to come out. You can also call or text your out-of-town emergency contact occasionally to see if they have additional information about the situation in your area. Epidemics and pandemics. If your area is experiencing a biological event, be it the aftermath of an attack or just a highly contagious and nasty strain of the flu, you may want to isolate yourself from other people until the threat passes. It's important to note that the limited number of epidemics and pandemics that the Earth has experienced means that there is not a pool of experts who have been there and done that to provide us with proven strategies to follow. Instead, I've consulted with survival experts, and I'm sharing their combined wisdom with you. The sections will be expanded and refined if there's a pandemic approaching, and I will keep you informed of changes via email and blogs. Now, we're going to spend a few lessons on the subject of surviving without leaving your home, but there's a couple of items that are specific to biological events. Number 1, do a gut check and make sure things are really to the point where you need to isolate yourself from other people. Are you being overly paranoid? Is the risk of sickness great enough that it's worth risking your job and/or relationships? And number 2, get your story straight. If you can't pull off looking and sounding like you're not home, put a sign on your front door explaining why you refuse to answer. It could be, wife pregnant and we're not answering our door, or baby sleeping, please don't knock or ring the doorbell, or mom just finished chemo and we're not answering the door, anything like that. I would not suggest putting up a sign saying that you're sick as a ploy. The possibility exists that sick people will be gathered up so that they can be helped and isolated from the general population. It's doubtful that officials would believe that nobody is really sick in your house if you have a sign up saying that somebody is. You want to try and create an impossible argument so that anyone reading your note will leave you alone and won't think you're just being rude. Whatever you decide on, you must stick with it and do not tell anyone that it's merely a ploy. 3rd, decide what you're going to tell your employer, coworkers, friends, and family. They may not have prepared like you and may or may not appreciate your concern or the fact that you're isolating yourself from them. Try to be as nonchalant as possible and as noncommittal as possible. If things don't get as bad as you think they might, you don't want to have burned any unnecessary bridges. The most awkward time in a situation like this is going to be the time between when the people who are aware start taking action and when the majority of the population realizes that there's an issue. Fourth, get daily sun exposure. If possible, get it where people can't see you and won't be tempted to talk with you. Number five, stay out of sight as much as possible, drawing curtains if necessary. Number six, decide your response in advance in case, quote-unquote, help comes from any government agency that wants to put people together to, again, quote-unquote, help them. Number seven, get daily exercise to combat stress. Number seven, decide early on what trigger you'll use to start going back out into public. Number nine, set limits on how much news you will watch, read, or listen to. Keep in mind that the media's primary job is to keep your attention so they can sell advertising. It's not to motivate you, educate you, or help you through a disaster. I anticipate that the phrase, if it bleeds, it leads, will be particularly accurate during a biological event. And number 10, take operational security precautions when you're talking with people about the flu and your plans and preparations. If there is a break in the supply chain and they think that you're hoarding food, vitamins, or medications, they'll be coming to you when they need help. I'll paraphrase James Rawls by saying that charity is great during a crisis, but it should be anonymous and on your terms. Next, we're going to cover ghetto medicine, otherwise known as field expedient or improvised medicine. Now, here's some of my favorite non-conventional medical treatments. Keep in mind that you're responsible for your actions. By even listening to the following, you are accepting the risk that these treatments may hurt you or others, and they should only be used after doing your own research and getting proper medical training. And finally, they should only be used as a last resort when you have no other options. These tip tricks and shortcuts can help anyone, but are really designed to help people with formal medical training train their mind to see alternative methods of treating themselves and patients when they're in a non-ideal situation. I'm a former first aid and CPR instructor and believe that everyone should have this level of training at a minimum. The classes will teach you several things, including how to respond to basic traumas and medical emergencies, as well as how to communicate with EMTs and paramedics. That being said, it will not teach you how to deal with injuries or medical situations when you don't have someone with more training who's coming to relieve you very quickly. It's for that reason that I encourage you to get wilderness medical training of some sort, like wilderness first aid, wilderness first responder, which is also called woofer, wilderness EMT, or outdoor emergency care, which is primarily for ski patrol, trail patrol, and search and rescue. You may ask why. Well, it's because all of the wilderness medical training classes assume that you're going to be away from an ambulance, helicopter, and other higher level medical care and supplies for an extended period of time. These classes force you to improvise, adapt, and overcome to treat people with what you happen to be carrying with you and what you can find in your environment. This skill set most closely fits what you'll be facing in a disaster or emergency situation. Now, here are some of the tricks that either I or one or more of my contributing experts, including a former Navy SEAL medic, combat medics back from Iraq and Afghanistan, local paramedics, and first responders who operated in New Orleans after Katrina have used over the years that you'll surely benefit from. First of all, crazy glue or super glue. At the time of this writing, I've used super glue and crazy glue on four facial cuts, a cut on my knuckle that went to the bone. I was on a hunting trip and was fortunate not to have cut any nerves, tendons, or ligaments. And numerous smaller cuts on myself, my dog, and others, as well as blisters and hot spots. I found that crazy glue works a little bit better for me. And by better, I mean it dries quicker and thicker. But the 12 packs of super glue are so convenient that it's the main brand I use. It's cheap enough and it has enough uses that it's worth buying a few tubes and practicing with it on your hands and or feet. Now, super glue is very effective at securing skin to skin, so do not touch the glue with a finger to see if it's dry. Instead, use a piece of string, floss, paper, or a similar item that you don't mind being stuck to for a few days. As a rule of thumb, if I'm on the fence about whether or not I need to get stitches, I use super glue. If I already had a serious cut where the muscle needed to be sewn together, I would not use super glue. In normal times, I get medical attention, and in a disaster, I would attempt to use a suture kit or dental floss and a needle if I absolutely had to. Now, some people have an allergic reaction or asthmatic reaction to super glue. Don't wait until there's an emergency to find out if that's you. Take the time to try a small amount of it on your skin and see if you have a reaction. Make sure you do this in a well-ventilated area and have a responsible adult with you who can get you to medical treatment if necessary when you do this. Again, you have to be responsible for your actions. As a note on personal responsibility, allergic reactions and severe asthma can kill you. You are responsible for your actions. Do not try this if you've ever had an allergic reaction to superglue, anticipate that you might, or if you were apprehensive about trying it. If you aren't allergic to it and decide to use superglue, the first thing you want to do is irrigate and clean the wound, then control bleeding with pressure and elevation. Next, again, clean it out with sterile water or saline and pat dry. Ideally, you want to use something sterile. Anything other than sterile and you're going to risk infection. So then you want to close the cut with a butterfly bandage or tape that you cut like a butterfly bandage. When the skin is lined up in the way that you want it to heal, then you go ahead and apply a layer of super glue. Keep it pretty thin. It will sting, it will burn both your cut, and the fumes will possibly burn your eyes. If the cut is an inch long, you want to apply the super glue approximately a quarter inch to half an inch to the side of the cut so that it has enough healthy skin to grab onto. Spread the super glue with a toothpick, metal pin, or the tip of the tube if you must, but never use a Q-tip or cotton. Once the glue dries, in 1 to 2 minutes, go ahead and apply a second layer over the top. Now again, you don't want to touch anything to it that you don't mind being stuck to for a few days. As a final step, cover the super glue when it's dry with athletic tape, duct tape, or a bandage, making sure to use gauze, cloth, or paper to keep the tape from actually touching the super glue. The butterfly super glue combo will hold the wound closed, and the covering will help the super glue stay in place as long as possible and keep the wound from getting dirty. You can also use super glue on hot spots and blisters, but frankly, I've found duct tape to be superior in almost every way for this application. Now, make sure to use super glue in a well-ventilated area and try to avoid breathing in the fumes or letting them hit your eyes, especially if you wear contacts. Inhaling the fumes can cause flu-like symptoms or an asthmatic response. It can also cause an allergic skin reaction, so make sure to test it in a non-emergency situation first. You also want to avoid touching the super glue with cotton, clothing, cotton balls, or Q-tips, as it causes an exothermic reaction and can burn or irritate your skin. Now, there are less toxic medical super glues available, including several brands of liquid bandages and even prescription-strength Thermabond. I've tried every commercially available liquid bandage I've seen, and I haven't been impressed with any of them. They are less toxic, but they just don't work as well. And in my experience, they dry slower than super glue, they wear off faster, and they don't hold wounds together as well. The best liquid alternative to stitches that I've used has been Dermabond. Unfortunately, it costs $20 to $50 per single-use tube as opposed to $5 for a 12-pack of super glue that gives you the possibility of multiple uses per tube. Dermabond is the perfect combination of fast drying, high strength, high durability, and low toxicity. I had an ER doctor use it on a cut directly under my eye with minimal effects from the fumes. Because of the toxic nature of superglue and the reactions it causes in some people, I cannot categorically tell you that it will work well for you as it has for myself and others. As a result, I encourage you to try out some of the medical superglues that you can find anywhere first aid supplies are sold. Number two is maxi pads. There are some medical and hygiene items that there are few good substitutes for, and maxi pads are one of those items. If you live with or spend time with any women who are in their menstruating years, it's just smart to have maxi pads in your 72-hour kits and or med kits. Now, I carry maxi pads for another reason as well, and that's to use as an absorbent trauma dressing. They will soak up a lot more blood than a 4x4 bandage, and it makes more sense than ruining a roller bandage simply soaking up blood and applying pressure. Now, a note on tampons. I used to carry tampons to pack puncture wounds from sticks, poles, and presumably from bullets and stab wounds. Over the last few years, EMT and medic experience in the field has shown this to be a bad solution for small injuries because the tampon swells and tears healthy surrounding tissue as it soaks up blood and expands. You'll still see people promoting the use of tampons and duct tape, but I strongly suggest that you do not pack wounds with anything that will become an integral part of the clot and has to be eventually removed. If you get the patient to a higher level of care, tampons are a pain to remove once clotting has started, and if you're looking at leaving the wound packed for an extended period, you risk septic infection. If you're a guy and you're not up to speed on feminine hygiene products, tampons or cotton plugs, for lack of a better term, with a string attached for easy removal, and maxi pads are rectangular absorbent pads with an outside coating that helps keep the clotting action of the wound from attaching the pad to the patient. Two other alternatives to absorbent dressings that you may have with you in emergency are disposable diapers and adult undergarments. Number three is dental floss, and I learned about the wonders of dental floss when I was doing ski patrol. One of the issues that you face with wrist, elbow, shoulder, or arm injuries is swelling of the fingers. If you're wearing a ring and your finger swells up to where you can't remove your ring, you have a potentially serious problem. If the finger keeps swelling, the ring will eventually act like a tourniquet, so it's important to remove the ring as soon as possible. Unfortunately, you aren't always able to start providing care before the finger is too swollen to remove the ring. If you do research on ring removal, you'll find people giving advice about using every type of lubricant known to man. But dental floss is the simple solution that's widely regarded as the best by EMTs and ER nurses. Try to get the widest wax dental floss you can and start wrapping the ring finger starting at the fingertip. Wrap the floss around the finger all the way up to the ring, making sure that you wrap tight enough and close enough together that the finger and the floss together is still smaller than the ring. Once you get up to the ring, do a few more quick wraps to push down sections that you've missed and remove the ring quickly. As a note, you can also use VCR or cassette tape for this. It's important that you try this on yourself. One of the things that you'll notice immediately is that speed is key with this technique. Your finger will start to swell as soon as you're wrapping it, and you'll have to go back and wrap over sections that have swollen in the few seconds since you've wrapped them. This effect will be even more pronounced with someone who's experiencing distal swelling due to an injury, and speed will be even more important. Number four is sugar. In the movie Shooter, Mark Wahlberg poured granulated sugar into his bullet wound to help it heal. And believe it or not, this treatment has been written about since 1700 BC and is known commercially as sugar dyeing. And it's very popular for treatment of injuries in horses. Now, the simplest and most effective mixture is sugar in a 10% iodine or betadine solution. Simply pack or cover the wound with the mixture and dress it. The mixture works in part because bacteria doesn't grow in the presence of pure sugar. The sugar absorbs fluids, promotes drainage, and the betadine and iodine prevents infections. Even after 3,700 years of use, the instructions for how often to reapply vary widely from every 4 to 6 hours to every day. The common advice is to apply a fresh mixture when the old mixture has completely liquefied. Number five is gunpowder. And this technique was made popular by John Rambo when he packed a wound with gunpowder and lit it to cauterize the wound. Please don't ever attempt to do this. Do not cauterize a wound with gunpowder. The basic premise, though, of using gunpowder on a wound actually has a basis in truth. Gunpowder, actually known as black powder, is a combination of sulfur, charcoal, and saltpeter. And these were common wound treatments for over a century and are still generally accepted naturopathic treatments for wounds. Unfortunately, the modern handgun and rifle ammunition that you shoot does not contain gunpowder. It contains smokeless powder, which is usually nitrocellulose or a stable form of nitroglycerin. In any case, modern ammunition does not have sulfur, charcoal, or saltpeter and will burn like heck and not do much good in a wound. Number six is safety pins. Safety pins are wonderful survival tools. In addition to using them as an improvised fish or animal hook, a zipper handle, and a quick fix for shoelaces, they have several medical uses as well. You can use large safety pins for finger splints, to drain a blister, close large wounds to prevent debris from entering, and even as an improvised sling. To use safety pins as an improvised sling, all you need is an injured patient with a long sleeve shirt on. Simply put their arm in the position that hurts the least and start pinning the sleeve to the body of the shirt. Once you're done, they'll probably still be able to move their arm around because of the shirt being loose against the body. To fix this, draw up the extra material under the good arm and knot it or pin it so their shirt is tight against their skin and the injured arm is immobilized as much as possible. Number seven is duct tape. Who could forget duct tape? Duct tape is a survivalist friend. And here are 16 more reasons to carry at least a full roll of duct tape in your kits. Number one is hot spots or pre-blisters. And simply apply duct tape directly to the area, making sure to cover an area bigger than the hot spot. And number two is blisters. cut a piece bigger than the affected area, put paper or cloth between the blister and the tape, and you're good to go. Depending on the blister, you may or may not need to build up the area around the blister to relieve pressure or pop it to continue using the affected area. Number three is a temporary cast. Once you set the bone, you can wrap the bone or the joint in newspaper and then wrap the newspaper with duct tape until you get to a higher level of care. Number four, if you're wearing dress shoes or cheap shoes that are falling apart in a survival situation, a few wraps of duct tape will get you a lot more mileage out of them. And number five, if your shoes are completely thrashed, you can make improvised shoes from duct tape by wrapping your feet. Place extra layers in front of your toes to give them a little extra protection from stubbing. And to pad the bottom, you can use all sorts of stuff, cardboard, carpet strips, or anything else you find in your environment. Number six, gaiters. Since blisters are so detrimental to effective movement, if you find that you're repeatedly moving pebbles and debris from your shoes, you can make duct tape gaiters by wrapping tape around the top of your shoes and legs a few times to make sure no debris can get into your shoes. Number seven, knee support. Many people wear a tight wrap under their knee to provide support. Wrapping a 3/4-inch strip of duct tape around the leg twice can accomplish the same thing. Number eight, knee support. If you experience a torn ACL or MCL and don't have knee support, you can splint your knee with duct tape and any available stiff object, a stick, a bar, rolled newspaper, file folders, cardboard, etc. Number nine, sutures and stitches. If you can hold a wound together temporarily while you apply duct tape by using super glue, butterfly bandages, or improvised butterfly bandages, you can provide additional lateral support to the wound to keep it from reopening. Just remember to put something, be it paper, cloth, gauze, or whatever, between the wound and the duct tape so that the duct tape won't stick to the wound and open when you remove the tape. Number 10, a sucking chest wound. Simply tape three sides of a plastic bag over a sucking chest wound to create a butterfly valve. Number 11, neck brace substitute. If you've got someone secured to a board, chair, or anything else, you can immobilize their head with duct tape instead of the traditional wrap. Just make sure to put something between the sticky tape and the patient's hair. 12, dog paw protection. If you're in an area with sharp rocks, ice, or debris, you can tape your dog's paws to protect them. They will lose significant traction, but saving their pads is often worth the trade-off. You can wrap them initially with roller bandages to keep the tape from pulling their hair when you remove it. 13, finger splint. Use duct tape along with a popsicle stick, safety pins, Bic pen, folded file folder, or even rolled up duct tape. 14, for mass casualty incidents, you can use duct tape stuck to the patient to record triage information as well as other vital information. As an alternative to triangle bandages, you can use them for providing an anchor point to apply traction to arms or legs. And finally, as an arm splint, find where the arm is most comfortable and secure it to the body. Of course, this isn't all, but these are some of the more frequently used medical uses for duct tape. I'd really suggest that you go get a roll of duct tape and try several of these techniques on yourself and with a friend or family member. And go ahead and critique each other and try to figure out why certain methods work better than others. Be very careful with duct tape and body hair so that you don't end up looking like a man-o-lantern. You may also want to shave a small area or do most of the exercises over clothes to minimize pain. Now for a review and this section's resource page. Number one, you should really decide what you're going to do with your pets in the event of an airborne threat. Number two, do a test run in your safe room using blue painter's tape. Monitor everyone's pulse and get used to being able to take vitals quickly. Number three, if you know that you are not allergic and have no medical conditions, try using super glue on your skin to see how well it works for you and how long it stays on your skin. Number four, practice using dental floss to remove a ring from your finger and from somebody else's finger. Next, practice some of the duct tape medical treatments. And finally, make sure that you have duct tape, pads, super glue, safety pins, and wide floss in your 72-hour kits. The resource page for this chapter can be found at urbansurvivalplan.com/306. Or, if you want to, you can go to urbansurvivalplan.com/306/ Lesson 6 Resources. For more information on entering and exiting safe rooms, I've got a special report at urbansurvivalplan.com/299.